Welcome back to BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare, educational, and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host once again, Brian Moore, and in this episode, I'm joined by some of our interior design and architectural thought leaders at BSA to talk about designing for the user experience. This episode features Jen Worley, Justin Beadle, and Elaine Avila-Banaug. Jen Worley is the Director of Interior Design at BSA and has been with the firm for nearly 8 years. A graduate of Ball State University with a bachelor's degree in psychological science, interior design, and environmental design, Jen worked for HKS for over a decade and also with Ratio Architects. She has several designations, including EDAC, RID, LEDAP, ID plus C, and is a Lean Six Sigma Yellow Belt. Jen was previously on the show in episode 15, talking about the case for interior design as part of the planning process. Justin Beadle is a design principal with BSA and also serves as the St. Louis studio director. Prior to BSA, Justin worked for Blitz, where he held several roles: principal, design director, project architect. Justin received his Master of Architecture and Master of Construction Management from Washington University in St. Louis. He is a registered architect and a member of NCARB. Justin previously joined me on the podcast in episode 21 talking about design culture. Elaine Avila-Banaug is a senior interior designer, Denver studio interiors lead, and is CHID, EDAC, NCIDQ, and RID certified. She graduated from the University of the Philippines with a bachelor's degree in interior design and the Academy of Art University with a Master of Fine Arts in interior design. Prior to joining BSA, Elaine worked for Flat Architects and Smith Group. Welcome to the show, everybody. Thanks for joining me.
Great to be here.
Jen and Justin, you guys have been guests on the show before, but Elaine, you are joining us for the first time. Can you tell us a little bit about where your passion for interior design comes from and your journey a little bit?
Yes. Hi, Brian. It's great to be here. So, well, as a child growing up in Metro Manila in the Philippines, I was quite fond of creating art. My mom thought I would, since I was the only girl, she thought I would be the girly girl and have dolls and all that, but I wasn't into that. I was into crayons and pastels and poster paint and charcoal. And at one point, I even poured a jar of black paint on my bed, over my bed, and she wasn't so happy with that artistic expression. I also like rearranging my room periodically and checking out houses in various neighborhoods. So I think that was something I got from my mom, since she was into furniture and decorating, and she owned a home decor store at one point. Fast forward to my adult life in graduate school, my passion for healthcare design came by way of senior living. I was trying to come up with a final project, and my peers were proposing luxury hotels and high-end entertainment malls that didn't resonate with me. And so as I was trying to figure out what to do that summer, I asked my friend, hey, could I volunteer at the skilled nursing facility where she worked at? I thought it would be a good way to spend time. And that was a very foreign concept to me, being in a skilled nursing facility, because similar to Asian cultures, it was common in the Philippines to grow in a multi-generational household where grandparents lived with their adult children and grandchildren. And I wanted to understand and know more about that. So the volunteer work gave me the idea for my final project. I wanted to come up with design a place where you could age with dignity. And also I wanted to design a center where that offered various levels of elderly care. That way, as your health changes, it places less stress on someone having to transfer to another facility. So I found that very meaningful, and the idea of improving the quality of life of these elderly people, and the fact that I had no idea or I didn't know anything about senior living was very challenging and exciting for me. So years after at completing graduate school, I was hired by a firm in Hawaii to work on their first CCRC. And then afterwards, I joined Smith Group in San Francisco at their senior living and healthcare interior studios. And that's where I learned more about healthcare.
That is quite the journey.
Yes.
all over the place. I know you've also recently relocated from Tampa to Denver, so you've kind of been all over. And I did pick up on, and I remember from conversations with Justin and others, you know, these unique backgrounds of like, oh, I was obsessed with Legos, or I liked to rearrange my room. So definitely tracing some of that back, that fabric is throughout BSA, of course. Let's talk a little bit about our topic, of course, designing the user experience. So, Jen, how do you begin to understand the users that you're designing for?
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Thanks for having us on to talk about this important topic. For me, design is for and about people. It's really a walk in empathy. We seek to understand the users that will be living in this building. We want to understand what value means to each of them. We do a lot of different exercises that I'll talk about in a minute, but we really want to define the must-haves for them for their project to be successful in their eyes. In addition to that, we want to uncover what we call the delighters sometimes. What are those special things that they didn't even know that they need that may push their project over the top, push them forward in the marketplace, just getting them thinking differently? So we want to define those things to understand what success looks like to them. So how do we do that? We have a patient experience framework that we use for a lot of our healthcare projects. We seek to understand the client's current perceptions and challenges, and then to define those future needs based on value for each stakeholder group. And one of the exercises we do is called Voice of the Customer, where we put the shoes on of each major stakeholder and look at value through their lens. We also meet with multiple groups to get different points of view to come together, to get a diverse background of information. And then eventually we start designing. So a lot of this is really just defining the problem or defining the issues that surround a project so that we can design effectively and efficiently and, you know, maybe think about things a little bit differently. And then always continuous improvement. So we want to have some information in there that we can measure going forward so that we have a feedback loop of what worked on projects and what didn't work on projects. And a lot of that question and early discovery and definition really helps us understand what are those nuggets that we can then measure on the back end to help us understand what went well and what didn't go well. So there's just a lot of different things that we do for mapping user experience. We have the voice of the customer. We can do persona mapping, which is really about key touch points along the path for different users. We create storylines and different points in time to better understand their needs, behaviors, and motivations for different kinds of things. And that's used across a lot of different industries where they do the persona mapping. Also, building a sense of place in the environment. I think it's always important for us to understand the context of the people that live and work near the buildings where we are building projects. So that's always something important too, to make sure we have community involved.
A ton of work goes on in the early stages, right? Before you ever put, you know, I don't know if pen to paper is the right term in the modern age, right? It's probably all computer driven. But Justin, how does your architectural philosophy then incorporate user-centered design principles?
Yeah, really just building on what Jen said, you know, it's all about the people that will occupy these buildings that we design, having empathy for them and their experience there, you know, last time. And even earlier, you mentioned my Lego friends and the stories that I would create with them, you know, not just like a building and then there's like a scale figure that sits inside of it, but like, why would something be shaped a certain way? And so as we design buildings, you know, what, 30 years later, I haven't played with Legos this week, definitely not. As we design real buildings, we're thinking about these as scaffolds for people's lives, whether that's during a given health event or their blossoming education or some world-changing research that they're doing. We really want to think about what's the best background and like the most supportive environment for those things that can both, you know, not get in the way of the actual important things they're doing, but can beyond that, you know, help them do it better, faster, with more care and comfort, depending on what the project type is.
So then as an architect, how do you balance out those, you know, codes and architectural requirements while creating positive user experiences?
Yeah, I think it's sometimes as complicated as it seems, and sometimes easier. You know, in a lot of life, we see things in dichotomies, right? Like good and evil. And then we go right to building code and human experience. And how could these two things ever get along? And I think that that's sometimes the case, but it isn't always the case. And it kind of can't, especially when you're dealing with things that are as complicated as we are, you'll always be able to find some sort of alignment between some of the technical requirements and some and the experience you're trying to create. So first, we need to make sure that we're fully understanding the requirements and not just doing what we did last time or what we heard or what we were taught, but that we can actually document and understand the architectural requirements that might apply to a certain space. And once we feel comfortable-ish with those, but not overly burdened by them, we can really start to think about user experience first, because we've all been to those buildings where they're like, oh yeah, it keeps me totally dry, but I don't want to be here, right? Like, it meets all the technical requirements, but this isn't the place that I want to live or get care or whatever it is. So we really need to think first about user experience and then layer in those technical requirements in a meaningful and helpful way.
That's really interesting, especially talking about, you know, a lot of buildings that are meeting the tech requirements, but they're not enabling that flourishing of innovation. And it's almost interesting when you do see those buildings, they stand out so much because so many other buildings are plain.
I mean, I think that's right. And there's a place for background buildings and there's a place for being a good neighbor, like Jen said, and these buildings are a part of an ecosystem, but there's a deeper thing that happens when you're in one of these special places that kind of goes beyond what's expected. And I think that's really what we're striving for. Teams at BSA.
Eileen, what methods do you use to test design concepts with potential users before implementation?
I think throughout the project, it depends on what phase we are. For example, at the beginning of the project, we look at visioning sessions. We look at precedents and benchmarking to ensure that we align the design principles with the client's mission and values. As we further develop through the project, we also gather user feedback. We ask them what works, what doesn't work, and why. We also look at existing research, such as white papers or presentations, data-driven design or evidence-based design, as well as POEs. And then as we reach, let's say, construction administration, we have mock-ups, which is, I think, the exciting part, since people then can test it out, like pilot test installations or go to manufacturer showroom visits and trade shows. And there's technology, the use of technology through virtual reality walkthroughs and simulations. So there's varied ways to test and validate these design concepts throughout the life of the project.
Do people get pretty excited about the VR? Like
I've tried it. I've tried the goggles, but I tend to get disoriented. So I'd rather. At one point, I had an iPad, and it was, I guess, linked to GPS coordinates. So whenever I moved, the iPad moved as well. So I found that less disorienting. But yeah. It can be quite fun.
Interesting. Yeah,
you can always tell when you might have a client that's a secret gamer, because if they can really get the VR quickly, like, oh yeah, that's cool. So that's always funny.
They're giving themselves away, right?
Right. Some people have a reaction to it, but most people really enjoy it. It's a really interesting and new way for us to test those concepts quicker than building them out of mock-up or building them as a real on full finished mock-up.
How has your approach to user experience design evolved over each of your careers?
Well, I think over the years, I noticed there's been a greater push for evidence-based design and research, because the analytics that it has provided has been valuable for designers and clients to make informed design decisions. And as a result, this has affected positive satisfaction surveys. I mean, even in daily life, like if you, let's say, go to a spa or try out a new coffee shop, you get a Yelp or Google review about how absolutely wonderful it was to, let's say, someone traveling to a hotel and tells you that service was great, the room was clean, and to healthcare, where you've got HCAHPS scores that are so closely tied into revenue outcomes. So that's what I've noticed over the years that has evolved.
Evidence-based design is so important because users are, you know, we trust them and we like them, but you can't always trust them, right? When things are really bad, we know this in our own life, they're really bad. And when they're really good, and we kind of exaggerate. And so filtering that somehow through evidence and research is a really critical part of the process that maybe you don't imagine in academia, when I was in grad school or academia, that would need to happen in that way. I think alongside that, the complexity of projects has really caused my approach to evolve here. At the beginning of my career, I think I really thought about it as, you know, I would define an experience and then we would deliver on that. But the process becomes really as much about consensus building as it is the design of the space, because we have these user groups that Jen talked about quantifying in the beginning and interfacing with, and how do we bring them along to really understand an experience we're trying to create and not just, you know, say, here's the experience, kind of fit into it. And with that, the feedback cycle is so much faster than it used to be. So the process is faster. Eileen talked about VR, and I think that's a part of it here. But it used to be, you know, that you push like your render button and then you'd go to bed for the night and you'd wake up the next morning and be like, oh, that looks really great. Or, oh, that doesn't. And you're like, it's a 24-hour cycle. And
right.
That's no one's expectation anymore. Right. Everyone is expecting to be able to walk through their space and see it. And that's really great, but it also speeds up the feedback loop a lot. And so we have to think about how are we moving in a nimble way to react to that and deliver on
right.
it.
That's a good point. Jen?
Yeah, I agree with both Justin and Eileen about evidence-based design. I think sometimes design can be viewed as subjective. So it's always important for us to root our design decisions in something that's is rooted in research, in addition to those preferences that people have for different design concepts and experiences. Also, we talked a little bit about being able to measure project success. I think there wasn't always an emphasis on that in the past. Sometimes good design was just good design, and that was fine. I think now people are demanding more that good design is measurable, and it's a part of the designer's team's job to push forward, be good stewards of the resources that we have available to us for projects. One other thing that's come to light more recently, I just had a conversation with a client about neuroaesthetics. So this is fascinating to me. I know very little about it, but I'm learning more and more. So John Hopkins Medicine is studying this concept with their International Arts and Minds Lab. It's a multidisciplinary program that looks at the intersection of brain science and the arts. So they're trying to understand the neurosystems and pathways that link to aesthetic experiences and reactions to those aesthetic experiences. So understanding how designers can tap into something that's really in your base brain to make you feel comfortable is super exciting to me, especially for healthcare design. I would love to learn more how to do that.
Well, I find that fascinating too. And as you learn more, I'd like you to tell me about it. I might even, that's a really good topic just maybe for the future for you and I to dive into as well. That's fascinating. What's a project where each of you maybe where you received some user feedback that dramatically changed, and I'm being dramatic when I say dramatically, but maybe changed the initial design concept?
Yeah, thinking of a project Eileen and I have been working on in Texas, and the team spent the better part of a year working on a design for a particular site for a medical building. And I think we had sorted out the user experience fairly well there, but it didn't end up meeting the needs of the client because of some site constraints. It was a pretty constrained site, and the building kept getting taller and taller, and the parking kept getting smushter and smushter. And so in the end, the client decided to actually basically double the site. They bought an adjacent site and we totally undid everything that we did and started fresh from the beginning. So that's the most dramatic, I would say. We're about halfway through design on that now again. I think we're starting.
I'm going to use, what'd you say? In my
smushter and smushter.
Smushter.
It's a highly technical term.
I like it. I'm going to work it in my vocabulary. Jen, did you have any examples?
It's a similar one. It's a project actually that I got to work on with Tim Spence out in Colorado. It was also site orientation related. So we took a building and actually flip-flopped it on the site after schematic design. And so it sounds real easy, right? Oh, just flip the building, put this over here and this over here. Yeah, it wasn't as easy as we thought it would be, but it really had to do with the site and access to the site and the way the flows were going to be best as you approach the hospital versus the outpatient side. So it turned out to be a great decision, but it was challenging to execute as we went forward.
I bet you can't just flip it, like you said.
Like Revit doesn't have a flip button.
So Justin, I want to come back on something. I'm fascinated by this idea. Like, how do you ensure that your vision or the vision of the project is supporting the evolving needs of the users? You got this group on one side that has a vision of what they want it to be, and then you've got all maybe this data and research and user feedback that's speaking a little different to what the vision is. So how do you balance those things out?
And it's compounded, or the difficulty is compounded by that feedback process I talked about earlier and how quick that is and the expectation we have for kind of instantaneous results. And so I think the only way to navigate that is through process and discussion with our clients, really needing to be careful not to dial things in too tightly early before we really know everything. You'd probably be surprised how often we're a significant way into design when some really significant revelation about the way they plan to use the building comes up. I think just moving in a progressive way together is really important, not staying up super late to get everything perfect and then being disappointed when you present it to the client and they're like, right, actually, I want to do it this way instead of that. So moving in a progressive way with our consultants and our teams so that we kind of get deeper and deeper into things, not overbake it before we fully know what we're doing. And it's really our job to lead the clients in this way, help them understand where we are in the process, help them think conceptually early on, like this is kind of over here and this is kind of over there. We're talking in bubbles. We're not talking in walls, windows, and doors yet. And what we're looking for them with that, we're not asking them to get deep into the furniture for the space yet, but sometimes that's where people are most comfortable, where they want to live. And so we have to kind of help them pace themselves and their teams and give us appropriate feedback at the appropriate time so that things really move and progress towards a full building in the end.
Yeah, not putting the the cart in front of the horse, if you will, by talking about furniture when we're still in the thought generating stages. What role does technology play in enhancing the user experience of physical spaces?
Well, technology is I view it as a very neutral tool. You could use it for positive and negative. So it can play an important role in enhancing user experience, but it's important to keep in mind that technology becomes so obsolete quickly. Like our iPhones from last year are now not applicable, or it's just old news. So I think there needs to be a prudent consideration of when it comes to investing in its relevance and longevity. I think a client needs to understand and consider the costs and effort associated with the maintenance, content, upkeep, and if they decide they upgrade or completely change the technology later on. I think a common one you'd see would be an interactive directory, like in an airport or a medical facility that helps visitors navigate through the building. Some places are great at maintaining that interactive directory and some are not. For the client or the facility, are they willing to maintain a directory with this level of bells and whistles, or would they prefer something more static and simple and not have to think about all that stuff? So if not, it may contribute to a downgraded perception of that facility or an airport if they don't maintain it.
I think what Eileen's talking about is really the most common model that we see for technology and buildings to relate to each other. And it's been around a long time with the tech systems we think of now, but also other systems that power these buildings. And it's kind of a platform model, where the building is like the scaffold, and then we layer in technology or we layer in whatever else we need. And there's a flexibility there that's really nice for people. Things could be changed out, maybe like Eileen's talking about, over time, or sometimes they're not, and that's not great. But there is also the inefficiencies that come with that. We have this extra space for the unknown that might come someday, or we have redundancies in systems because we didn't really lean too heavily on this or that. But I think where things are really moving is to a place of integration, where technology is really an augmentation of the building. I think it's maybe useful to think about electric cars here. So like an electric car isn't exactly just a better version of a car. It's actually a transformational change because it allows you to receive over-the-air updates for your car, and different features can be enabled in different ways without you needing to go to like your repair shop and they're like bolting something new on your car. It really changes the way your car can serve you. And so I think buildings can move that way too, where we can think more agnostically, like, is architecture the way to solve this problem, or is interior design, or is technology the way to solve this problem? An example might be in operating rooms, right, where physical requirements are changing these days, and for a long time it's been maybe bigger and bigger, but actually in some ways we see some of that shrinking because of certain technologies that are being used. The space isn't required anymore because the technology can mitigate that in a different way. And so if we design more closely with technology, I think sometimes there's efficiencies there that we don't always think of, and it can become a building that really, you know, technology can really augment the building in the way that we think of augmented reality and glasses, right? Like, it's this layer and we see both things at the same time, and that really multiplies and makes for a better experience than we could do with, you know, walls, windows, and doors alone.
That's a really interesting thought. And I think it segues really nicely into my next question for Jen about how do you create spaces that can adapt to changing user needs over time? You're talking about some of that flexibility.
So one thing that we think about a lot is the ability to have choice, choose your own adventure, so to speak. So options of levels of engagement always makes me think of books when I was a kid. You could take which page and pick a different ending each time. Some people really want to engage with technology and with experiences such as maybe there's an art program and you can look on your phone to say, hey, this piece is over here. I want to go visit that piece. And then there's other people that would rather just sit in the cafeteria. So just having those options of ways that you can interact with the space, as well as creating a sense of control to adapt the space. So if you have furniture that has different options of postures, as an example, is something that we can do for flexibility. Modular components, kind of building off of what Justin was saying about having a project that had modular panels on all of the walls on the interior, so that you can pop off a panel and then make the upgrades and pop the panel back on without disturbing or very, very little downtime. So they're turning around very quickly with that. So the other thing that I see happening with adaptability is really the different ways that people are looking at healthcare now. It's really a shift from treating the sick to being a wellness partner, and the idea of things like flexible community rooms in a facility. So that lends itself to modularity. So having modular glass walls that might push open and close so that you can have support groups or community events at your campus. Demonstration kitchens is another one that we see with that. I think the idea of having a health campus, a health district where you're getting people to the healthcare site for things other than just treatment is becoming more important, and that lends to the flexibility conversation as well. And the other thing, thinking about experience. So as Justin was saying, experience will change over time, as well as the way the services are played out in a facility. So we have to build in some of that flexibility going forward.
Talked about those specific requirements earlier, and I think we also work with clients that have very specific brands. And so the tendency can be to design facilities that are really purpose built. And that's important, but it's also important to think about flexibility over time. We really hope that these things we're building and investing a lot of time and resources into will outlive their first imagined use. So we don't want to get so specific in terms of the structure that we're creating that it couldn't become another thing. So that's how I think about flexibility. I mean, the only way to do that is to actually think about that at some point during design, like call a pause or a timeout of some sort, and think about what this might look like in 30 years. And think about that with your client. Maybe they imagine the building transforming in a certain way once it's renovated after a generation. There's really ways we can be intentional there if we actually stop and think about it.
Really interesting insight and thoughts there from both of you. Eileen, how do you balance the designing for, I'll say, quote unquote, the average user versus accommodating for a lot of diverse needs?
Well, I think it's important to know your target demographics. Who are we designing for? In the case for, let's say, K-12 and healthcare project types, it's easy to identify that, or it's easier. But for project types that may serve a broader population, I think it's important to be empathetic and inclusive in our approach. As designers, we do need to advocate for all types of groups. Over the decades, I've seen that we've evolved from designing for the physically disabled. And now we're also taking into consideration designing for those with sensory sensitivities, which is how we're seeing all these studies on being neuro-inclusive, like, and trauma-informed design and universal design. So there's many approaches now coming up.
It's interesting you mentioned the sensory sensitivities. My youngest daughter, she's coming out of it now. She's 9 and a half, but there for, I'd say from 4 to about 8, 9, she was very sensory heavy. And we had to incorporate that into her education plan. So it's one thing if it's there, but if it's in other places like health facilities, that's going to help them a lot along their journey as well. Eileen, can you also share an example, maybe something that was seemingly small in terms of design detail, but had a major impact on user experience?
I think years ago, when I was a younger designer, I worked on a VA project for a blind rehabilitation center. And the center prepares service members that have been injured in combat or acquired a health condition that resulted in vision impairment to transition to life without sight. So actually, my cousin served in Afghanistan, and he was one of these people where he knows eventually he will be losing his eyesight. And being blind means doesn't necessarily just mean that you cannot see anything. It could also mean that you can see some light and dark. He could see from a limited distance. You may have peripheral vision. So the senior interior designer I was working with at that time selected a flooring material with a contrasting tone and an embossed texture. And the reason for that is so that when they approach the nurse station where that flooring material will be located, people that can differentiate light and dark and can see shadows can immediately determine that, oh, I'm approaching a destination point or a care team station. And folks that depend on auditory cues, such as tapping a walking cane, can notice a difference in sound as they approach the nurse station. So details like these help people transition to the outside world. I guess an example would be if you're at the train station and you're waiting at the platform, you have those rumble strips or those embossed strips that tells you, okay, if it sounds like this, you're at the edge of the platform, but closer to where the door will be, versus if you go to the side of it and it sounds different, you are at the edge of the platform where the door won't be. Those little cues help people.
That's really fascinating. Wow. These sensory things that you're talking about, really, really interesting. From what I've learned in my short time here, the user experience has evolved over the years and played an important role in healthcare. Can you guys elaborate why that's been the case?
I think healthcare clients have become savvy in understanding the implications of a positive user experience. And the reason for that is because HCAHPS scores correlate directly to positive revenue and reimbursement from Medicare. It correlates to better public perception and reputation, as well as staff retention and recruitment. So I think for a project type like healthcare, these clients let us know or raise concerns early on in the project if they think or if they perceive that a certain design approach will lead to patient dissatisfaction.
So to relate this to your world a little bit, Brian, think about brand and the way that's evolved to just mean logo and color to mean something more that has to do with the experience. And we think about the reasons people might choose to go to one healthcare facility versus another. The experience that accompanies the care is really important there. An obvious example of this in architecture was Apple, right? Where there's a certain feeling or experience that they create in your stores, and you're not confused that you're at the Dell store when you're at the Apple store. And people really look to do that in healthcare and really any building these days. It's a way to differentiate yourself. And so we want to think about that as part of the user experience. We want to include the way in our thinking that visitors proceed through the space and the way that staff are supported in the building. It's really important to think about patients for sure, but also we want staff to have longevity. And people might choose to work one place versus the other, depending on the amenities offered or even the ergonomic accommodations that are provided to them. So these places can really care for the people just in their design. We can also think about this in terms of programming. We've all been to that lobby that has a vending machine versus like a complete food and beverage offering. And those, either of those things signals something to people about the type of space that they're in and how long you're welcome to stay for, or maybe even what you would expect when you go to meet a doctor beyond the wall. And so it's important that we create a really continuous and kind of supportive experience that sets people's expectations of starting outside the building, coming into the lobby, and then proceeding into the exam room after that.
That is a really good one, Justin. As you were talking, you're right. I think brand in general for any industry has evolved so much over that, I would say, decade plus. They're so much about the user experience. And I immediately thought of Chick-fil-A. Used to be you would go to these places. It's like, just give me my food. Here's your food. Great. But now there's a little bit more into it. It plays into our vacations and where we travel and sports, the in-game user experience that people are experiencing when they're there. Concerts. We went to a concert last year, and the lighting was a huge component of the show that they were putting on. So it's fascinating to hear how that's impacted in our world and what we do with the work that we do. It's evolved really everywhere, to your point.
Yeah, I think Chick-fil-A is a really funny example and maybe a good example to connect back to the beginning when we think two things are opposed, because it's like, how can this place make me feel so welcomed, but also give me the food the fastest of any place? And you might think those would be like dichotomies, right? That you couldn't be the fastest and the most hospitable, but somehow they do that. Yeah, we just got to be careful when we think things are opposed. You can sometimes have the best. You
can do both, right? Yeah. So this question I've been dying to ask since I invited you guys all on, because it's something that I'm not in your day-to-day worlds, but I hear a lot of these things, right? We're always designing and working with multiple user groups, and they all seem to have somewhat different needs. Sometimes they overlap, but it seems like sometimes they have different needs. So how do you guys prioritize those needs?
That's the challenge, isn't it? Right? They have very diverse and larger user groups with some of these projects. And maybe that's why they come to a professional. We've talked a lot about evidence-based design in this podcast. So I think that's part of it. Filtering a lot of what we hear as feedback through research and evidence so that we can make recommendations as professionals as to what the best way for them to proceed might be. And also to think about who the right group is to help us make that final decision.
Yeah, to jump off on Justin's point, one time I did work with a client, and it was great because they had this committee called the super users, and their role was to be the final decision makers, because they are the people that sees the big picture, or they see everything. And so I think it's important as we work with clients to ask them, what's your decision-making process? Does everyone get a final say, or is there a group that synthesizes and filters all these comments and feedbacks and figure out what is the best decision for them as a client?
That's interesting.
To build off of I think Justin's points from earlier, sometimes we do think that the client has had more conversations about projects than maybe we understand that they have. So really being direct and asking those specific questions, sometimes we assume that we know who the super user is. And we may guess wrong if we don't ask that question directly. So I think that's been a big lesson learned for me personally, is to really make sure I'm understanding who that group is.
What is one essential principle you believe all designers should follow to create meaningful user experiences, regardless of the project type or the size or scale?
Well, I think good design can be both functional and beautiful. It's not exclusive. So I think that's my design principle.
I totally second that. I think that's really important, especially as we're doing such complex work here at BSA. There's always an elegant solution to be had for those design problems. And I've talked a lot about empathy, but I really feel like that is, for me, the biggest, most important thing. Really listening to the client and being curious about them can foster a meaningful user experience.
Yeah, Jen stole my word there, but curiosity is really a big thing, and empathy is a form of curiosity. And I think that really applies across the spectrum. We use so much shorthand in our lives just to get through the amount of information that we deal with in any given day, but staying curious as to what someone's real experience might be is actually a discipline. And it's also an exercise in curiosity to look at those technical architectural requirements in a new way and be curious about the why that might be behind them, or what if we did this slightly different version of that? Could we achieve something that we haven't before? So I think the curiosity is really part of
I always like to wrap with a futuristic kind of what's coming next. What emerging design concepts do you see in the experiential design across different sectors?
And we've talked a little bit about this, Brian, already. I think whole person well-being being supported within the built environment is really important, taking into account that we are multi-dimensional beings. And we have a variety of needs, from basic safety and health to social needs and feelings of belonging, and really putting more emphasis on that, I think, going forward will be interesting. And I touched on this a little bit earlier, but the idea of the health district, how can the healthcare campus get you to the campus for things other than healthcare, things that support your wellness and well-being? So the idea of having a farmer's market on site or a food pharmacy, which is really interesting, or maybe there's a community garden that people can contribute to, wellness classes, community events. So really, you know, connection to those social services even, I think, are things that hopefully we'll see in the future. Really, that whole person well-being supported from beginning to end is what I hope we're looking for. Also, local businesses being on the healthcare campus, supporting them is another thing that I'm starting to see emerge, which is interesting.
Yeah, the farmers market one is really interesting for sure. They all are, but that one really caught my ear.
Yeah, we have a project that actually has a sky farm. It's a farm on top of the podium. And if the employees will spend time in the sky farm, they can take the vegetables home for free. Oh. They also cook the vegetables in the servery.
I think design is a differentiator, just really continues to expand across project types. And that just means that companies or art building users are differentiating themselves from their competitors. Or other employers through design. That happens a lot in Silicon Valley. We hear about that, but we see that in healthcare in different ways too, really thinking about how the approachability of a place might be something that really causes you to choose one facility versus another. Thinking, of course, about being less institutional and just doing the right things in terms of cleanliness and professionalism of doctors and all those things. We don't work with anyone who's not there, I guess, professionally, but we really, really want to make sure that we're supporting that and signaling that from the time that you drive past the building and creating a place where people really want to come and really even want to work.
I think, yeah, to go off Jen's point, there's been a trend towards more community-centered design solutions that impacts people's behavior, where they tend to promote certain habits and a specific lifestyle into your daily living, and also layering in technology into your daily living. An example is a couple of years ago, a former coworker of mine submitted a research paper on how do you see the doctor. And it could be that maybe you see the doctor while you're on your commute on a train. And so you're kind of killing two birds with one stone. You don't have to commute to your doctor. Your doctor's on your commute and you get to work in time. So it's coming up with unique solutions that people wouldn't think work together to build a lifestyle that, you know, seamlessly folds in for your daily living.
That's a really good one to end on, just because I think of, you know, we all seem stretched for time. Any ways that we can sort of multitask, that's a really fascinating one. Well, this has been great. Thank you all for joining me. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
I'd like to thank Jen, Justin, and Eileen again for joining me on this episode of BSA by Design. You can connect with them on LinkedIn. If you want to learn more about BSA and our expertise, we encourage you to visit our website at BSA. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information. Be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. And we've got more content and project stories to share on social media. So be sure to follow us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and X. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.